Hey everyone, we thought we'd give you all some bonus content this week. As you know, we've been trying to kind of record some extra stuff in the midst of the quarantine as we're all stuck at home. Wherever you're listening from, I hope your quarantine is starting to wind down. There are signs of that starting to happen in Ontario, where Will and I live. But for the foreseeable future anyway, at least for the next few weeks, it looks like we're all going to continue to be stuck inside. And what better occasion for making and listening to podcasts is there than that? So because our last episode dealt with Bill Hicks, and because we got, I think, an unusually high volume of listener feedback, Will and I decided we might kind of go over some of your comments in detail. I also did a post on our Patreon page recently that some of you may have seen, kind of talking about, you know, what comes next for the show, some of the things we have in mind. So I thought we might flesh that out a little bit more. Some of you also weighed in with comments, and I thought this might be a good opportunity to discuss some of that. And then our third agenda item is kind of dipping our toes into this Michael Moore controversy that I'm sure real heads will be aware of.
I love that we're now expected to have opinions about Michael Moore. Yeah. And like whenever anything happens that's Michael Moore related, I get people tweeting at me or messaging me saying, "Hey, have you seen this?"
Well, lonely is the path of the Ronin. But here we are. So we're gonna get into that a little bit, though. As I said, neither of us have actually seen the film, but we're gonna talk about the controversy a little bit nonetheless.
Yeah, it's not gonna stop me from having an opinion.
You know, our last Patreon episode was about Bill Hicks' revelations, and as you'll remember, Will talked about a very Toronto-specific Bill Hicks anecdote, which was, of course, the postering campaign for this Bill Hicks bar. And if you go onto our Patreon page, you'll see that I was able to snap a photo of one of these posters just about 10 minutes away from my house. It's incredible. Since I took this photo, I've seen like 5 or 6 more of these posters. They're years old and they're everywhere. So the spirit of Bill Hicks lives in our city. Go over to the Patreon to check that out.
Don't you feel like you put on the They Live glasses?
Yeah, you put on the glasses and, you know, you just see Bill Hicks saying like, you know, whatever happened to music, you know, the Rolling Stones, man, you know, that they had some balls. People weighed in with comments on Bill Hicks, and it seemed like, just like us, people had very complicated feelings. Amusingly, Michael posted to say that he's been contracting in Toronto for the last year and that he saw exactly one of those posters. So he's also wearing the Bill Hicks They Live glasses, which is funny. Friend of the show, Liz Ryerson, left a very long and thoughtful comment. She says, I did actually find Lenny Bruce funny when I was 17 and downloaded some of his bits on file sharing networks. So I guess that would be, you know, downloading Lenny Bruce bits on, you know, Kazaa or LimeWire at sort of like 0.2 kbs a second. For me, it was Adam Sandler. It was the latest edition of the Hanukkah song.
Here's the thing. When you spend that much time downloading something, you are invested in finding it funny.
Yeah, that's why so many people got into Smash Mouth. It was because they had to leave Kazaa open for 5 days in order to listen to like a really shitty quality version of All Star. Anyway, Liz continues, I also grew up in a very conservative Christian area in middle America, and it was during the height of the Bush years, so that might have something to do with it. I was very into the idea of the lone truth teller. I'm not sure if I'd find it funny now, but I do like the idea of Lenny Bruce's comedy being this very contextual thing that people who managed to be in those clubs at the time when he was being arrested got to experience and interact with more at some level. I feel like I enjoyed it knowing it came in that context. I just don't know if it was ever meant to be taken out of context.
I definitely think there's something to that, yeah.
Definitely. And the comment continues here. I think there's plenty of Bill Hicks material that doesn't hold up to much scrutiny when you're talking about in a political context. And there's some usual sexist stuff, though, not nearly as heavy as other comedians at the time. But some of it still does, especially if you're comparing it to other comedians of his ilk. I also think he has some very funny bits. I always thought his delivery was excellent. He has a lot of range and dynamics in his voice, like a musician. I think he's underrated as someone who's funny. Most of that comes out in his albums, Arizona Band, Rant in E Minor, which came after his death. I always found Revelations to be pretty canned. And actually, you know, I put this to someone else recently, a friend of the show, Branko Marcetic, and he was saying that, you know, he thought Revelations was the least funny Bill Hicks one. And my own memory is that Rant in E Minor and Arizona Bay were funnier. So maybe we didn't give Bill Hicks his due, and we should do more of that.
You know what I'll say in defense of Bill Hicks is that his bit about Jay Leno is extremely funny.
Oh, I love that bit. Also, the bit about Rush Limbaugh getting off to Barbara Bush.
That's good stuff, incredible. Yeah. You know what? He is funny. Forget it. Forget everything I said on that last episode.
So just the comment concludes, maybe the most kind of challenging bit of the comment. Liz says, okay, maybe this is a controversial take, but fuck it. I do think there's a bit of a lack of self-awareness of lefty irony podcasters saying, like, these guys should just be funny and stop trying to be political about older comedians like Hicks or Bruce or George Carlin or whoever, because I don't think enough people reflect on how this stuff is contextual. And the comment continues for a bit. And Liz is very clear that we are not being accused of falling into this. But I do think that's interesting. I agree with the spirit of it. My only comment is that I'm actually unaware, maybe I haven't seen it, of these older comedians being accused of that, although, you know, maybe they were. I think when we revisited Bill Hicks, what we found was that even if what he was doing at the time might have kind of worked then, it's hard to watch some of it through the lens of everything that's happened since and kind of not see it in relation to that. So now when there are so many comedians who don't even feel like it's their responsibility to be funny or tell jokes just to make good points, it's difficult to go back and watch something like Bill Hicks and not think that he's kind of doing the same thing, even if that's kind of a little bit unfair to him. Jim says, as extensively described on stage by Stuart Lee, Hicks's reputation doesn't have to endure his decline phase because he doesn't have one. Who would he be today if he were still alive? That is such a provocative question. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Have you heard that idea that's very popular that maybe Bill Hicks would have become Alex Jones had he lived long enough? I don't necessarily believe this, but he's somebody who's sort of conspiratorial and vaguely political without being associated with any one particular ideology.
The variant of the theory that I'm familiar with is that Bill Hicks is Alex Jones, or rather Alex Jones is Bill Hicks, because there are certain side-by-side pairings where the two Texans look remarkably similar. That's what I thought you were going to say. But I mean, there is maybe something to that if one has the most cynical reading of Bill Hicks. I'm really not sure. I mean, I have to say, I think my unsatisfying answer to this is I worry that he might become one of those kind of political correctness guys, which that's not what I want to believe, but I feel like that's kind of the most likely possibility. Who knows? I could be wrong. But he could be one of those guys like Stephen Fry or something, you know?
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, I feel like a lot of my older comedy heroes now have, like, their Twitter timelines are just them retweeting a lot of stuff about Trump.
All your favorite comedians, all of Will's favorite comedians, like especially his favorite one, Greg Proops, are just all on the resistance bandwagon. You know, like, you know, the amount of Siskel and Ebert that Will has binged pales in comparison to the Greg Proops bits on Whose Line Is It Anyway? That's a joke, by the way. I'm not sure that the irony there came across. So I just want to exonerate Will. He has not, in fact, actually watched that much Greg Proops.
But I feel like David Letterman is the quintessential comedian of his generation, because, like, when he started, he was sort of loosely anti-authoritarian, somewhat combative, somewhat of a disgruntled figure. And now that has tens of millions of dollars, he has a Netflix show where he just, like, interviews Melinda Gates. And I don't know, I'm not sure that Bill Hicks ever would have become that. But
yeah, I'd like to think not. So Mark says apparently Hicks was quite popular in Britain, according to the doc American Scream, which was made by two Brits. His political material didn't fly too well in the States at first, but British audiences ate it up, sticking it to the Yanks, I guess. That's really interesting. I was completely unaware of that. There is one Hicks segment that I recall where he talks about Britain, but it's that segment about football hooligans, and the joke is like Brits complain about hooligans, but they're actually just this, you know, the most non-dangerous people ever, which that's kind of a bit that seems like tailored to American stereotypes about what, you know, how meek British people are like, which I don't imagine would have been received that well in Britain. But I'm interested in this because it speaks to something I've wanted to talk about on the show for a really long time, which is what might broadly be called the special relationship between Britain and the United States. I mean, officially that phrase refers to the fact that since 1945, Britain and the United States have had an official foreign policy alliance that's called the special relationship. But I think there's actually a lot more to it than that. There's kind of an unspoken cultural dimension as well, where the two sort of make fun of each other, but also overly idealize one another. And this has a lot of implications, which, you know, we'll need to do a whole episode on it at some point. But one of them is that often American acts, whether they're bands or comedians, will do really, really well in Great Britain and be completely unknown or not very successful in the United States, and vice versa, which I think is a really interesting dynamic. So I didn't know that about Bill Hicks, but
would he have been as well received had he lived long enough to go over and do a vicious 20 minutes about how Tony Blair likes eating shit, or, you know, whatever his joke would have been?
Well, hell, sign me up. I would have loved that one. Some other Hicks tidbits from Mark here. He knocked on doors in L.A. and got offered a pretty good studio deal as a relative nobody, but walked away. He was an accomplished guitarist and did all his own music. I believe he started as a musician. So that actually puts those musical segments in all the hits.
Chicks Dig Jerks, that classic single.
I mean like the little musical filler bits when there's a sort of like what sounds like just a knockoff version of Purple Haze or something like that playing in the midst of a set. If he's playing that, that's actually substantially more impressive than if he just got some generic studio musician to record that. So moving on to some of the feedback we got on the What's Next post from April 30th on the Patreon. There was a lot of feedback on this one, and I just wanted to go through them quickly. Apologies if we don't get to your comment or we don't get to it in detail. Like we've said before, we do read all this stuff and we really appreciate it. There's just not always time to discuss everything. And if your comment gets omitted from the discussion, it's not because we didn't find it useful or interesting. It's just because we don't have the mental bandwidth to kind of give equal time to everything. So the fault is ours, not yours. So just to begin off the top, QW says, love the show as always. What about doing an app, doing a decent movie and announcing it beforehand to give listeners a chance to watch too? I love that idea. We should do that. Someone else says, as much as I like the ironic stuff, I've also been enjoying the more serious looks at, well, good movies. A balance of both modes is nice. It's hard for me to make it to live digital hangouts, but if you're able to make the video accessible later, put the audio on a podcast feed, that would also be cool. And also happy to fill out a survey if you put one together. So, you know, this comment is responding to a number of things I said.
We should have a question, who's the most handsome host?
I mean, I already know the answer. That would be an entirely rhetorical question, of course.
I agree.
But, you know, so that question alluded to, or that comment alluded to a few things that I said in the post. So something that we're very keen to do is some sort of digital hangout. By the way, if anyone has kind of technical knowledge of how exactly we might pull that off or what software we might use, hit us up in the comments. That would be very helpful. But, you know, we thought about doing something where, you know, we watch a movie and you guys can all watch with us and we can all kind of communicate in some way as it's happening. Something else I'd like to do, I know a lot of our listeners also listen to Chapa Trap House and contribute to their Patreon, which, you know, is almost as big as ours. They recently did three kind of riff track style episodes about the Star Wars prequels. And I think that might be fun for Will and I to do at some point as well. Lastly, about this comment, I had asked, do people actually like these more serious episodes we've been doing? And it seems like the consensus choice is yes, but perhaps as we scroll down, we'll find that.
Yeah, I want to hear some dissent. I want to hear somebody who doesn't like them.
So Brendan says, since the Rambo episode and also the Reagan episodes of The Dollop, I've been personally thinking about how the politics of the Reagan years were a prototype for the politics we see now. I'd be interested in exploring more of the fascistic 80s movies that primed so many Gen Xers and older millennials to become the ghouls that we are left to deal with today. I agree the survey is welcome. I'd be happy to fill one out. So I think we will have a listener survey at some point. Brennan, I think that's a fantastic point. I'm really keen to discuss Robin Wood's book, Hollywood from Vietnam to Reagan.
Tell me if I'm talking out of my ass here, but I think a big difference between the Reagan years and also the Bush years and now is that in the United States, at least, people don't seem to take quite as seriously that all that talk of American exceptionalism. In the Bush years in particular, there was this constant talk of, you were against, say, the Iraq War, if you were against the Bush administration, you were anti-American. But you never hear anybody talking about anti-Americanness now. That kind of rhetoric, which I think also flourished under the Reagan administration, seems increasingly irrelevant. Am I wrong, do you think?
I'm not entirely sure. It's a provocative point. I guess the point is well taken. I think the big factor there is the absence of the Cold War. It's hard to be anti-American if there's no kind of foreign power that you can be accused of, like, acting in concert with. And of course, there's been an attempt to sort of reinvent that with all the Russiagate stuff. And now amid the coronavirus, you know, there's been an attempt by the right and also by some liberals as well to sort of make China the new bogeyman amidst the unspoken but very obvious imperial decline going on in the United States.
And I feel like it hasn't entirely caught on because the imperial decline is so obvious, you know? A lot of the political rhetoric seems to be directed towards who to blame that decline on, rather than to pretend that the decline isn't happening, you know?
Someone suggests it'd be cool to have a Discord server.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we should talk about that.
Michael has a film TV suggestion. He says, they're a little more on the trend humper side of things. I really loved your conversation about the Fire Festival last year. I think it'd be cool to hear your review Tiger King, as it seems to be hitting a lot of the same justice porn pleasure centers as Fire did.
Luke, we were talking about whether or not Jacobin would have a Tiger King article. You and I both watched Tiger King. What's the Jacobin take on Tiger King?
I mean, I don't think that there really is one. I mean, I was discussing with some colleagues kind of in a mostly jokey way, you know, what if Jacobin had a Tiger King take? I can't remember who brought it up, but this was kind of kicked around for a little bit. And we couldn't really settle on anything because it doesn't really have politics. It's just, you know, it is just kind of
a freak show.
It's a freak show to these very strange people. I don't know. I'm not actually opposed to doing it for Michael and us, but...
Carol Baskin is Hillary Clinton, and the Tiger King is Donald Trump.
Michael continues, as someone who works in TV animation, I think it would also be pretty cool if you made a Michael and Us Field Guide to Parenting episode. I already watched The Adventures of Tintin on Luke's recommendation, and I'd love to see what other family-oriented fare from the past decade you think holds up. I mean, that is such a sweet idea, and I'm so honored that you would trust us to recommend things for children to watch, which I think is a question that someone has put to us before. I mean, off the top of your head, Will, are there any other children's movies you'd recommend?
Here's the thing about kids. They'll watch anything. I have a recommendation, actually. I would be curious what today's kids would think of Time Bandits. Would today's kids sit still for Time Bandits? I would be curious.
Oh, we should watch it sometime because it was a really big movie for me when I was a kid and it scared the shit out of me. So I don't think that is a recommendation for kids, but a kind of strange one that no one will have heard of. I mean, granted, I have not seen for 20 years, but a film that I was really fond of when I was a kid, which is on YouTube, I'm sure, is an adaptation, a kind of claymation adaptation of a Russian folktale. And it's called The Fool of the World and the Flying Ship. And I think it's about 40 or 50 minutes long, something like that. And it's a Russian fable, brilliantly adapted, incredible animation. Check that out. Really, really interesting. In fact, I might actually watch that later tonight. I've not thought about that for 20 years, but it's really cool. John says, as a citizen of Michael and Us Nation, I know it's important to vote and speak truth to power. So here goes. I support and would attend a live Michael and Us. Well, that is I'm sure, a very dissenting view among people that give us money every month and dutifully listen every week. But no, we're very keen to do it. So you guys will be the first to know. Obviously, we can't do anything like that while we're all kind of stuck in quarantine. But I mean, yeah, it's definitely something we've considered. JP also says live show, definitely. Just to please factor West Coast daytime working hours in the scheduling if you can. So say 9 p.m. Eastern if it's a weekday rather than 7 p.m. I assume that refers to some kind of live broadcast that people could watch on their computers. So actually, that is something we'll need to keep in mind. We'll try to, if we do that, put it at a time that works best for the maximum number of people to watch. But of course, we have listeners in Europe and Asia and all over the world. And so, you know, we may have to just kind of make the record of that available to people who aren't able to tune in live. But if it works well, we can do it more than once. JP continues, readings of pre-written content by you and others actually tends to be my least favorite part. And that's the same for Chapo too, so don't take it personally. I just think that you're at your best when you're riffing. I actually take that as a compliment, to be honest. However, I do greatly enjoy both of your writing, so more show-related written content would be cool. For me, the sweet spot is movies that are somewhat competent, but that give you a lot of material to dunk on in the filmmaker or certain aspects of the politics. Also, I unironically loved Rambo Last Blood.
Did it give you a lot of ideas for how to protect your home?
Pre-written content, I do, you know, that we kind of read out on the show. I mean, point is well taken. I mean, obviously, you know, if you're listening to a podcast, you want something novel and you can easily just go and read something yourself. I think we try to keep that to a minimum, but sometimes, you know, if we're talking about something in detail, it does make sense to read it within reason just so that you guys know what we're discussing, as opposed to the alternative, which is us giving you homework, where we say, okay, pause the recording and go read, you know, Roger Ebert's review of, you know, The Land Before Time or whatever.
Yeah. Luke, you know what I say? I say what I say goes.
Michael and Us Nation is a dictatorship.
But a benevolent dictatorship.
This is a mere plebiscite, like the one Napoleon held to legitimize his coup. So Borat, assume the one and only Borat, says, first, citizens Will and Luke, thank you for bringing this to the people of Michael and Us Nation. I can't make a live show, but if it's recorded, I'll listen to it. I think you guys have been on a roll lately, hitting good and bad films and using them as jumping off points to discuss wider politics. I think that's one of your core strengths as podcasters, so please keep up the good work. That's kind of like the opposite of the classic, when did you stop beating your wife, where it's just praise. There's nothing for us to say. So thanks for that, Borat. Much appreciated. Glad you're enjoying things. Ekaterina says, live show sounds great. I do like your more serious discussions, especially art theory criticism stuff. I mean, I'm reading over these in a very kind of passive, like, yeah, well, sure, we know we're good type of way. But I was putting these questions to you guys because I did want to make sure that us doing episodes on The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari is not completely off base, and you guys actually do enjoy that kind of stuff. So this feedback really is appreciated, and we will do a listener survey at some point. Gene says, the Fear and Loathing episode made me think that I'd love for you guys to do more episodes about writing, and that perhaps episodes about individual essays might be doable. The episode in the JFK doc made me think that an episode of Norman Mailer's Superman Goes to the Supermarket might be a fun one, seeing as it perfectly exemplifies the journalist campaign writer as myth maker thing. So I love that idea. We've talked about doing a Tom Wolfe thing for a while, so.
Yeah, and David Foster Wallace as well.
Are you familiar with this Norman Mailer essay?
I read it many years ago. I've mostly forgotten it. I would not call myself a Norman Mailer fan, so I think it would be worth revisiting.
Benjamin says, I want you guys to stick to the script. In particular, I would like you guys to take a look at mid-2000s war documentaries and maybe even a look at films such as Enemy at the Gates, Restrepo, Off to War, and maybe even Stop Loss. So it's true there's kind of been a dearth of stuff like that for a while. So we should probably get back to that. I mean, there's a few very obvious ones like The Hurt Locker that we haven't done. And I haven't seen. Can you think of anything in the same vein that we haven't done that's kind of obvious?
You know, he mentioned Stop Loss, which was an anti-Iraq war movie starring Ryan Phillippe from the mid-2000s and was one of many anti-Iraq war movies that came out in the mid-2000s. I think there was another one called In the Valley of Ella starring Tommy Lee Jones by the director of Crash, not David Cronenberg, the other Crash. And most of those movies, as they were coming out, they were all box office failures. People didn't want to go see movies about Iraq. Until American Sniper. Like, they wanted to see a movie about Iraq when it was about, like, a guy who was good in Iraq, you know? Like, a guy who could shoot from a really far distance. That's an interesting period in American film to examine a little bit. This is not particularly related, but I just want to raise it here. I've been wanting for a long time to do an episode on United 93, which Luke has been resisting, understandably, because it's such an unpleasant viewing experience. But I feel like there's something in United 93 that really, really captures something. It was a movie that came out with all this fanfare of, well, listen, folks, this movie had to be made. There was going to be a movie about 9/11, so just be happy that we made the most unpleasant movie possible about 9/11. And you should go see this movie as a self-flagellation exercise. There's something about that I would very much like to explore.
I mean, of course, then we'd actually have to watch it. But yeah, point is well taken. friend of the show, Jack Frayne Reed, has a couple of suggestions and says, you guys shouldn't cover the ghostwriter on the show because I want you both to come on and cover it on my podcast. That was something that we talked about when I went on Jack's podcast. And yeah, we're absolutely still down to do that.
Yeah, I would love to watch the ghostwriter. Big Nicolas Cage fan over here.
Benjamin says, if you guys can just rip into Garden State and the terrible genre of copycats it spawned. That's really interesting because I have a bad feeling. Well, no, because I have a feeling that I'm going to still like Garden State, like not in the same way that you like it when you're 14, but that I'm still going to think it's good, which like, you know, I think it may actually hold up in some ways. I mean, the second part of the comment, the terrible genre of copycats it spawned, I have absolutely no doubt the Garden State, like so many other things, even if it turns out to hold up, there's going to be like so many annoying things that you're going to find rooted in it that then later appear in movies like Juno, which I hated at the time when it came out, like at the zenith of Juno mania, I hated it. So that's an interesting one and kind of an outside the box suggestion. I like that. Mark says, I'm interested in hearing your views on more international topics. It might mess with the perfect Canadian strange brew that is Michael and us. I don't think so. I'm into that. And then lastly here in the comments, Tyler says, kind of an on the nose pick, but I've always thought the Tim Robbins directed Cradle Will Rock will make for a really fun episode. I mean, that's perfect because, you know, that's an Orson Welles related thing.
Yeah. And I've seen Cradle Will Rock. I saw it many years ago and it documents this project that Orson Welles was involved in, this national theater company that was part of Roosevelt's New Deal. And he put on this play by this, or he meant to put on this play by this communist playwright, Clifford Odets. And I guess the play was, it's been a while since I read about this historical incident, but I believe the play was canceled by the powers that be. And then they ended up staging it in such a way that like it couldn't be staged on the stage. So all of the actors delivered all of their dialogue from the audience. So it's a fascinating historical incident.
Well, I saw it a long time ago, but didn't have any context for it, so I'm keen to revisit that. So that's a great suggestion. As always, all this feedback, questions, comments, suggestions, super appreciated. We can't say it enough. You know, it's so amazing that there's this community around the show, that all you guys contribute, that you listen, that, you know, we've kind of brought you into all our little in-jokes and that you've kind of taken to creating other ones within the cosmology of the show. It's really wonderful. So before we go, I did just want to get into this Michael Moore controversy just a little bit.
Yeah, here we go.
So for people that don't know, this film was released on YouTube called Planet of the Humans. It is directed not by Michael Moore, but by a fellow called Jeff Gibbs, who I think was involved in Fahrenheit 9/11 in some way. And a lot of environmentalists and others are quite unhappy about this. I wanted to discuss the movie in detail, but as soon as I dived into the controversy, I immediately realized it's too juicy to do justice to in a few minutes. So, I mean, if we want to really get into it, we'll have to watch it. So maybe we'll do that. The other thing I realized is that it has clearly touched a nerve in the environmental movement that I confess I don't have enough context for the internal politics of the environmental movement to fully appreciate all the gossip and all the kind of back and forth. Because at root of the controversy is that the film goes after Bill McGibbon, who's a very well-known environmentalist, and he's written a blustering response in Rolling Stone that I have excerpted here. He says, basically, Moore and his colleagues have made a film attacking renewable energy as a sham and arguing that the environmental movement is just a tool of corporations trying to make money off green energy. One of the most dangerous things right now is the illusion that alternative technologies like wind and solar are somehow different from fossil fuels, Ozzie Zaher, one of the film's producers, tells the camera. When visiting a solar facility, insists, you use more fossil fuels to do this than you're getting benefit from it. You would have been better off just burning the fossil fuels. So that's kind of the burden of the controversy around this movie. Neil Young, no less than Neil Young, has said, the amount of damage this film tries to create, succeeding in the very short term, will ultimately bring light to the real facts, which are turning up everywhere in response to Michael Moore's new erroneous and headline-grabbing TV publicity tour of misinformation. A very damaging film to the human struggle for a better way of living. Moore's film completely destroys whatever reputation he has earned so far. So that's lastly, I have a clipping here from the journalist Katie Aronoff, who people will know from The New Republic. and who's very familiar with environmental issues. And she says, since Moore's 1989 debut with Roger and Me, his films have punched up with humor at automakers, gun manufacturers, healthcare corporations, and the Bush administration. Lacking both Moore's charisma and his grasp of political economy, Gibbs replaces Moore's concern for the lives and well-being of working people with his own concern for a planet he believes would be better off with far fewer of those people. Humanity and Planet of the Humans is the enemy, and any attempt to salvage its future are fair game for ridicule as the work of either profiteering liars or misdirected rubes. The film's turn towards population control isn't just nihilistic, but nasty and has an ugly history in environmentalism.
Well, I think that sounds pretty bad, but Michael Moore has never been wrong, and I also long ago signed a blood oath to endorse anything he says, and I'm not changing that.
So just finally, Michael Moore and Jeff Gibbs, and also Ozzie Zesner, who was referred to earlier, they appeared on an episode of Rising recently with Crystal Ball and Sagar and Jetty. And Gibbs says in the interview, "We don't attack environmental leaders. We need our environmental leaders." Gibbs also states that went to great pains to show you what's happening in the field of solar and wind, and many of our experts are in the solar and wind industry. I want to spark a holistic discussion about all the things we humans are doing and whether those green technologies were even going to solve climate change, let alone all the other things happening around the planet. So I have to say, again, without having seen the film, that sounds like a very press release-y kind of response. It sounds like a politician responding to criticism. But again, Will and I haven't seen the film, but also felt the need to kind of weigh in on it, because obviously Michael Moore looms so large as kind of the quasi-ironic patron saint of the show. So that's a little breakdown.
Michael Moore has literally never been involved in a bad movie.
Well, in any case, with a bit of a breakdown of the controversy there, I think we'll leave things at that for this kind of extra bonus discussion, and we'll see you all for the next regular one. Cheers.